This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Wabanaki Confederacy is an alliance of Native American nations that first came together centuries ago. They meet regularly to renew ties of friendship and discuss issues facing the Native peoples of a wide geographical region. This year, the Wabanaki Confederacy Conference is in Shelburne, and for the first time in 200 years, it's here. This has not been in Vermont for two centuries. What an amazing thing. It's being hosted by the Nulhegan Band of the Western Abenaki. There are ceremonies and plenty of social time, but there are also serious matters to discuss. Delegates will be discussing ecology, culture, politics, the preservation of art and language, and challenges like human trafficking. Today on the program, we're joined by Don Stevens, chief of the Nulhegan Band, and by Fred Wiseman, author, artist, and Abenaki scholar, to learn more about how the Confederacy hopes to address these issues. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Don Stevens, I want to ask you first, since you are basically in charge of hosting this as the chief of the Nulhegan Band, 2 days to go before the conference starts. Are you ready?
Yeah, as ready as I could be. But I'd like to make one quick correction.
Please
that
do.
It's actually being hosted by all of the recognized Wabanaki or Abenaki tribes in Vermont. I was contacted in 2014 by the Wabanaki chiefs to ask if I would manage this project or this conference and on behalf of the Western Abenakis. So I just wanted to make sure it's not just
the Nulhegan Band.
It's the whole Western Abenaki people in the United States.
Good. I'm glad you clarified. So it sounds like then it's been a lot of work. There are a couple hundred people expected to show up. You've organized this whole event. So is it something that is going to be a full event, full 5 days of activities and excitement and hard discussions?
Well, actually, today and tomorrow we're setting up for the conference. We've had a lot of great business supporters. Shelburne Farms has donated the coach barn and on Saturday the event at the farm barn. And we've had a lot of other support from the other communities like Lake Champlain Basin Program and the Vermont Community Foundation and other support. So these 2 days are really making sure that everything's in place. The actual conference starts at 7 a.m. On Wednesday and goes until about 8 p.m. at night with different things. Of course, that's only open up to the Native delegates. And on Saturday, the public event is 10 to 4, and that's open to the public. And that's a whole different – that's more of a celebration than a conference at the last day.
Fred Wiseman, what kinds of things happen at a Confederacy conference?
Well, basically there are about three or four themes that I've been associated with going to Confederacy conferences since probably about 1989, 1991. The first component, of course, is social, getting the different tribes together, hanging out, meeting. It starts with a ceremony. It's called a condolence ceremony where all the different delegates are welcomed by the host tribes. And it's kind of a touching ceremony. The last one that was at Pleasant Point, that's when our chief at Missisquoi, my tribe, had just passed, and the assembled delegates did a ceremony for my chief who had just passed. And so the idea is to welcome everybody, make everybody feel very comfortable. After that, then, there are meetings of the chiefs. There's generally a talking circle for chiefs. There's elders. There's healing circles, women's circles. There's a lot of vendors that come to these occasionally, so there's a lot to buy and see and do.
Sounds, Don Stevens, like there's also some really good food. I was reading your flyer about looking for donations of certain kinds of food, including moose and deer and fruits and vegetables. Sounds like you eat well at these conferences.
Yeah, we eat well, but you have to understand there's probably at least 150 people for each day of the conference except for Saturday, which could be any number of people. Saturday we were going to have some deer. I'm not quite sure if that's going to pan out, but yes, we eat well. We eat a lot of the vegetables and Native traditional and non-Native traditionals, non-Native stuff. So we have quite a meal for the suppers. We put on a big spread for everybody.
I want to remind listeners we're talking today about the Wabanaki Confederacy Conference. It's going to be happening this week at Shelburne Farms. And as Don Stevens said, open to the public on Saturday. And we'd love to know what questions you have for Don Stevens and Fred Wiseman, or maybe you're planning to attend and you'd like to tell us what you get out of these conference meetings. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Don Stevens, who's coming this year to the Confederacy Conference?
Well, the Confederacy, if people don't realize who the nations are, they're the Mi'kmaq people, the Maliseet, the Penobscot, Passamaquoddy, and the Western Abenaki. Those are the nations, the five nations throughout New England and Canada. So we have delegates from every one of those nations that are coming to the Confederacy. So we're having all of the chiefs and elders that are coming from these different nations, like I said, to come together to talk about things. And then we have other people from, obviously New Hampshire and various places of New England coming, also to help in the celebrations.
I understand that you have people other than those just from the five nations coming, that it's a bigger conference than usual.
Yes. Like I said, the last, as Fred was mentioning, in 2008, it was held at the Penobscot Reservation, and that's the last time it was hosted in the U.S., right? So we're also part of the Seven Nations Confederacy, the Western Abenaki people. Those were the people who fought on the front lines with the French back in the 1600s. That's when it kind of came to be. So we have nations like the Algonquin. We have people from Ganawage, some people coming from Akwesasne. So we have different those different tribes coming as well. So this is the first time in a long time that both confederacies have come together. And we'll discuss wampum belts and other things that are important to both confederacies.
So it's rare then to have both confederacies come together and have a meeting like this together.
It is. I think it happened at Odinac in the 90s. I believe Fred could speak to that more often. Yeah. But
Odinac up in Quebec.
Yeah. Normally they do not come together, but we're trying to change all that so we can kind of be united as the nations.
Fred, you want to add more to that?
Well, the interesting thing that originally the Wabanaki Confederacy and the Seven Nations and another confederacy that's not very well known called the Three Fires Confederacy of the Great Lakes were all parts of a much larger alliance that was called the Great Council Fire. And it wasn't until the 1800s when politics on this side of the border versus on that side of the border busted the Great Council Fire into components. And so one of the interesting puzzles that we have now is trying to put it all back together.
So are you excited about this coming together of many different tribes and nations?
Oh, yes. I've been I've traveled all the way from the Great Lakes all the way to Nova Scotia talking about the old alliance. And people are slowly coming around. And there's also a lot of movement in Native circles in general, thinking about reviving old alliances, not just this one, but many others in the Midwest and the Far West.
So what would you hope would come out of the conference this week that would signal more of an alliance or a return to more of an alliance between and among the confederacies?
I think the first thing is just for everybody to get to know each other. As I said, these have been sundered for a long time, and a lot of nations have rewritten their history and their culture to downplay the older alliance.
Why hasn't the conference been hosted in Vermont for more than 200 years?
Well, I think because there's been a lot of stigmatism around Abenaki. I mean, just getting recognition alone. Fred and I, we fought in the trenches, and we had to get legislators, sportsmen, citizens, and our own people, Abenaki, together to actually have a common goal to be able to get recognition. And a lot of the outside pressures that we have, there's still hate out there for Native people. There's websites and blogs that still they're not friendly to Native people, and a lot of that stuff, once it's on the internet, people kind of when they live far away, they get hesitant about, well, who are these people? And so, you know, the Confederacies have been watching us to see how the Abenaki people are here in Vermont. And we have been in touch with them for a long time, but they feel confident that, you know, that we can all come together. And because a lot of that stuff is now gone since recognition, a lot of that other, you know, noise, I want to say, is now gone, because we've, you know, we've proven ourselves 10 ways from Sunday, and, you know, that's gone and done with. So
what do you mean? What noise was,
well,
that?
What I'm saying is, when people say, oh, well, you're not real, and who are you, and oh, everybody's been to, you know, everybody went to Canada. And my thing is that, look, Fred and I will say this, is that when we first got recognition, we had to be reviewed by three independent scholars that had only the reputation to lose. And then the Commission on Native American Affairs had to vet us. Then we had to go through two or three meetings in the House and the Senate, and the AG had to sign off, and the governor. If we haven't proven ourselves by now, my thing is that how many other races or cultures have to go through that process to actually prove themselves? I mean, we're the only race that has to carry a card in our wallet to say we're Indian. Everybody else can self-declare. We can't, you know. So I'm saying is, we haven't proven ourselves by now. I mean, I don't know what else somebody would want. And they Indian country understands that, and they've accepted that. And like, this is bringing about these Confederacy meetings and all of that, which is awesome.
So does this feel like a big deal to you then?
Awesome deal. I mean, for me, it's it could be once in a lifetime, or it could be many. We don't know, because it happens whenever it happens. So for us to host this, it's a huge honor. And just for the Western Abenaki people in general, this is Vermont history happening today that people don't realize. I mean, you got to think, the last time that when this was formed, this was all New France. This wasn't even Vermont, you know. So you got to think about the gravity of these Confederacies coming together in Vermont. For Vermont history alone, I would say is huge. I mean, Fred might have more to add to that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I'm a little less sanguine than Don is about how accepted Vermont Abenakis are. I think the original stigma, both within Native society as well as Euro-American society, is pretty well gone. But there's still a hesitancy, institutional disinterest, I think I could put it that way, in indigenous issues. For example, many of the ceremonies or the crops or things like this that routinely are covered by major Vermont media outlets are ignored when we're dealing with Native issues. And that same thing occurs in New Hampshire as well as parts of New York. And so I think that things such as this conference here will slowly convince the media and or the public and or the powers that be that the Vermont Abenakis are A, real, and B, are not a threat, and C, are a cultural force to be reckoned with.
Maybe, Fred, you could just – I know we could spend an hour on this alone, but just to give people a sense of who the Abenaki are in Vermont and just a little piece of that history going back in time to what the Abenaki represent to us now, but also, you know, how important they've been.
In just a few minutes?
Yeah, I know. I know.
I teach whole courses on
that
question.
I know you do. Yeah.
Okay. First evidence of indigenous people in Vermont about 10,200 years ago. Probably a fairly large settlement of indigenous people in Vermont by 6,000-7,000 years ago. Fairly advanced culture with it's called the Laurentian Archaic. Many sites in Vermont. As a matter of fact, there's one that's actually on this on 40th and Allen. So there's a lot of evidence. But the issue for a long time was that, yes, everybody recognizes there were Indians here in prehistory. Yeah. They recognize that the Abenakis fought in the French and Indian War. But the big question always was what happened in the 19th century. And so a lot of people said they were gone. There's another kind of meme that's out that the Abenakis hid in plain sight. I think that they never hid. They were always accepted here, but people just ignored them and really haven't accepted the 19th and 20th century presence. And that's what I focus on today.
So it sounds like, from what we've done in the past and talked about, that there was a falling off in the census data of people
Certainly.
Who identified themselves as Abenaki.
So, that's correct.
So you don't think that people were not self-identifying, but why might they not have put themselves on the census?
By the late 1800s, it became less and less popular to be indigenous. Previous to that time, Vermont natives were very important. They produced huge numbers of canoes, baskets, all kinds of the transportation technology that was used in frontier Vermont. As time went on, that all became unimportant. And Native people such as Don's family and my family found it by the 1890s to best be changing your identity, that's called passing, into a Franco-Vermont. Still discriminated against, but not as harshly as Native. And then, of course, in the early 20th century, we had the eugenics program, which drove everybody way, way, way underground. And it wasn't until the 70s when indigenous people began to feel as though it was safe to come, I guess you could say, out of the closet.
So you do see that people went underground. You think that is valid? That you said that's a meme, but you don't think they were hiding in plain sight. But it sounds like you do think some people went underground because of the eugenics movement and because of discrimination.
They still maintained a Native identity. But, for example, instead of playing drums, people learned to play the same music on violins. And so it's really an interesting study. It's passing is not giving up your identity. It's reorganizing the way that your identity is perceived by the larger community.
Don, you wanted to jump in?
Yeah, I want to mention that, but within family groups, we still practice our culture. And because, I mean, part of the recognition process was to prove your lineage all the way. I mean, just my family alone, we went back to 1787 and decided that was far enough. Even the federal government only goes to 1900, but it showed the continuous stuff. And one of the things that we did was use the eugenics survey to show that we never left here, because they documented. How can the state argue with their own data saying that, well, how can we have left when you tracked us since all the way back to the, you know, on my family, 1787 to my grandmother? I mean, how do you explain that? And it documents in there that they did, you know, sold baskets and horses, and they traveled from place to place. And most of them were known as gypsies at that time or other derogatory names, but showed our we traveled in groups, and we kept our identity within our own family groups, but we didn't really stick our hand up and say, hey, look at us.
Yeah, but if you remember, Don, the state did fight with us about the eugenics data.
Yeah, they did, but they didn't. We won. We got recognition.
After 12 years.
So anyway, we put in a lot of struggles, Fred and I. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sounds like you two go way back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
We're talking today about the Wabanaki Confederacy Conference that's coming up in Shelburne. We're looking a little bit back in history now, but to bring us up to the present to better understand what is happening at this conference and why it's so important that it's being hosted in Vermont more than 200 years after the last time it was hosted here. Listeners, I'd love to know what questions you have. Maybe you have a connection you'd like to share with us. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Coming up, we're also going to discuss some of the issues that will be brought up at this year's conference, some of the issues facing Native communities today. You can post a note if you'd rather. Go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. The Wabanaki Confederacy is an affiliation of five principal nations. This year, the Confederacy Conference is in Vermont for the first time in more than 200 years. We're talking with Abenaki scholar and author Fred Wiseman and with Don Stevens, chief of the Nulhegan Band of the Abenaki. The Western Abenaki are hosting and organizing the Wabanaki Conference this year. And we would like to hear from some of you. If you have questions about some of the issues the many nations and tribes will be discussing this week at the gathering, you can call 1-800-639-2211 or post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. If you're a member of one of these bands yourself, we'd love to hear your perspective on whether a gathering like this is valuable and what you think the greatest issues facing your community are. You can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or again, our number is 1-800-639-2211. 1-1. Jennifer wrote in to say, interesting conversation today. I love the point just made about Native Americans being the only people who have to carry a card to prove their race. I am not officially considered Native American because of this. Is that something that still comes up for people that you talk to, Don Stevens, who say, you know, I can't prove my identity, but I know my identity. I know my family.
We get that all the time because, as Fred will also speak, is that there's a lot more Native people in New England. If they have a history, a family history in New England, and especially French, they probably have Abenaki lines somewhere. But according to the Indian Arts and Crafts Act and the Department of Interior, an Indian is a citizen of a recognized federally or state tribe, right? So if you are not recognized as a tribe, then you are not an Indian. So that's why we fought so hard to get recognition, so our family and our ancestors would be proud, and then now citizens of ours then are legal Indian, have legal Indian status. So other people who are not citizens of a recognized tribe, they can be descendants of Abenaki, but they don't have the legal status.
Let's go to Ken calling in from Ticonderoga. Hi, Ken. Go right ahead.
Hi, guys. I'm curious about how the Wabanaki are going to chip in, or if they're going to chip in, on the taking of tribal property in Arizona for foreign mining interests, and how that might help them out there and maybe prevent the same thing from happening back here in the East.
Ken, when you say chip in, you mean monetarily or weigh in on the issue?
Oh, weigh in, support, etc.
Thanks for the call, Ken. Either of you have thoughts on that?
The only Fred? Thing that I'm familiar with that's going on in Arizona is, of course, with the decline in coal, Peabody Coal Company, which had most of the mining in northern Arizona, all the leases and things like that. Those are going vacant, and it's being now taken over. Last time I was out there last spring, some Hopi friends were concerned, but I really didn't know that there was a major issue going on there. So I'm sorry.
And just from our point of view, normally what happens is, since we're all New England tribes, when I say New England, I mean Canada, the northern, northeast Canada, and also New England. We have a lot of issues we deal with, like, fracking up in Canada, and tar sands, and, Lake Champlain cleanup here, and then dams on the Connecticut River, and then other issues with governments, like in Maine, where the governor just removed a bunch of delegates from the legislative body. So we kind of deal with those. Now, we do work with other nations and other tribal nations that are outside of New England. But the way that would work, it would be a government-to-government relationship. Like those tribes or nations would come to the Confederacy chiefs, and then they would discuss it and see how they would want to proceed. Not one person would speak for the Confederacy because we all make up the Confederacy, and that's why they have a tribe webinar. Well, that's why I have Wabanaki chiefs to discuss these issues, and that's why we get together. But individual nations can do their own thing, but as a confederacy, those are discussed at these sort of meetings.
Well, and you just mentioned some of the issues that you'll be discussing that are both political and environmental in nature, like fracking issues in Canada and other parts of the United States, and Lake Champlain cleanup. You're going to be right on the shores of Lake Champlain. What are you going to be discussing about those two things?
Well, I think with the cleanup of the lake, I want to let people know, because Vermont was the most western territory of the Confederacy, where we were on the front lines of the battles and other things. But nowadays, obviously, there's no wars. But, we are still concerned about the lake. We still want to let people know what we're doing to clean up those waterways. And it's more of an informational kind of thing, but also to get support from people, right? So if we have an issue, they can support us. We can support them on issues. And when it comes to fracking, I mean, like I said, it depends on the tribe and who it's affecting. I mean, we have principles, environmental principles that we all live by, right? But I mean, if someone's in need and wants help, that's what we're here for, is to support each other. And not only that, but also from a cultural standpoint. I mean, we want to support each other from a cultural standpoint, so it doesn't get lost and we can learn from each other. It's like the old rendezvous.
You mentioned dams on the Connecticut River. I imagine the dams, the big dams up in native land in Quebec, are also an issue that you discuss.
Yeah, anything that's important to the indigenous population of where those issues are happening, that's what they bring to the Confederacy, and everybody discusses it. So we come up to speed, and then how can we support each other in those? Because I think Penobscot and Passamaquoddy at one point, they were having issues with some of the dams stopping fish coming up into their areas of reserves, and that was a big issue.
Let's go to Norm, who's calling in from Linesville, Pennsylvania. Hi, Norm. Go right ahead.
Hi. I'm currently living in Linesville, Pennsylvania. My family is originally from Odonek, and I grew up in Waterbury, Connecticut. Many of the Abenaki people were right after World War II wound up leaving the poverty of Odonek and looking for fruitful ground in order to raise families. And I'm a product of one of those, but I still have all my roots from Odonek. Card carrying, and I want to congratulate the gentleman on the phone, on the line today, on the program today, Mr. Wiseman, Chief Stevens. A excellent job.
Thank you.
I was introduced to the fact that there were many unrecognized Abenakis through Chief Roger Longto, and he enlightened me that the tribes within Vermont and New Hampshire were not the people were not recognized because they went underground many years ago. So I supported their fight for recognition, and I really applaud all of the efforts they put forth.
Norm, thanks for the call. You're getting smiles here from our guest today. Fred Wiseman, I'm interested to hear another issue that you're really looking forward to hearing be discussed at the conference this week.
Well, I think my personal feelings is the most important, by a long shot, much more than anything else, is the getting together and getting to know each other. Because we've been separated pretty much for decades and decades and decades. Very few Vermont Abenakis have ever gone to Confederacy meetings in Nova Scotia, New Brunswick. And so the Western Abenakis were woefully underrepresented. This is going to be the first time that people from those areas will actually see what is going on here. There's a tremendous, as Don alluded to, there's a tremendous amount of misinformation that is floating about, and I think that it's going to be important for people of Native heritage from all these other areas to come and see what's going on in Vermont on the ground. So, my personal feelings that we can talk about water or fracking, but just getting together, shaking hands, and just having those people see that there is something of value indigenous-wise in Vermont and has been.
You agree, Don Stevens?
I agree, and I also encourage people, citizens of Vermont, to come out and get to know who we are, because that's another front that we need to break, that barrier, that people know that their neighbors and friends are Abenaki, and we're not so bad.
We've been talking today to Fred Wiseman. He's an author and Abenaki scholar. Don Stevens is chief of the Nulhegan Band of the Abenaki. The Nulhegan Band and all of the Western Abenaki are hosting and organizing the Wabanaki Confederacy Conference at Shelburne Farms this week. And as Don mentioned, there are events that are open to the public on Saturday. We have a link at vpr.net. Coming up, some good news about bats and white nose syndrome. We'll brave the mosquitoes to follow along with researchers trying to figure out why a few members of one local colony of little brown bats are surviving the disease. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. A muggy summer evening in Vermont, in a swampy area, just as the sun is going down and the mosquitoes are thick in the air, might not sound like a good place to hang out. But it's ideal if you're a little brown bat or a bat researcher.
I would say of all the places I've been, the mosquitoes are definitely the worst here. You pull up in your truck and you'd better get in and out pretty quickly, or when you leave that night, you're going to have a truck full of mosquitoes.
Alyssa Bennett is the small mammals biologist for Vermont Fish and Wildlife. And on this particular muggy and buggy night, she was heading up a team of researchers, interns, and volunteers to study a population of bats in Addison County. A colony of little brown bats roost in a covered bridge over the Otter Creek each summer, and biologists have been studying them for almost a decade.
back in 2006, before all the population crashes of a lot of these other now state-threatened and endangered species, the Indiana bat was really the only one we were concerned about. It was a federally endangered species. And there was a concern that because bats were living in this bridge and the Vermont Agency of Transportation was going to be doing some work to restore the covered bridge, they were worried that they'd disturb the bats. So they contacted us. We came out. We set up some nets and trapped bats exiting the bridge and found out that they weren't Indiana bats. They actually were little brown bats, which at the time were one of the most common species. Scott, in his wisdom, my supervisor, Scott Darling, said, well, let's put bands on them so that if we see them show up in a cave, we'll know where they came from. Amazingly, then white nose syndrome hit, and we saw these enormous population declines, really devastating. Not only did we see colonies like this decrease, the whole eastern side of the state pretty much has no little brown bat colonies anymore. And they used to be everywhere, hundreds, thousands of bats in a colony. So we came back here in 2011 after seeing those population declines and captured bats again. And then 2012, 13, 14, here we are, 2015. So this is one of only a few sites that we monitor closely, but we have the longest records that I know of for the species of bats surviving through white nose syndrome.
So we mean right here?
Right here. Two bats that were captured in 2006, and then we captured them again, I believe, in 2013. So we know that not only have those bats survived a few years since the disease, they actually survived through the entirety of the disease. So we're collecting research samples tonight to answer some questions that some of our collaborators have over in different universities and colleges around the country. And they're trying to find out what is so special about these individuals that they're surviving when other bats aren't. So we'll actually take some samples that will allow them to look at the underlying genetics and even protein structures of those bats to find out if there's anything special. I don't know whether it's something special about this colony or if we have a situation going on where bats, for example, have moved from the eastern side of the state, the only ones that were left, and they've all kind of congregated in these areas. It's a question that everyone's still trying to look into.
Bennett and her team set up a couple different kinds of nets to trap the bats as they came out of the covered bridge and two nearby bat boxes. Most of the bats here are females and they're young. The males don't stay with the babies, so they're able to wander more than the females. Because they're mammals, they nurse their young. When the pups are first born, they stay in the nesting sites while their mothers go out hunting. But by late July, the pups are flying, or volant, and the whole colony comes out to feed on aquatic and flying insects. Pretty quickly after sunset, a few unlucky bats find themselves ensnared in a kind of trap called a harp net. The bats fly into the vertical strings of the harp net and slide down into a little plastic trough. Seven bats beat their little wings against the plastic sheeting, and the researchers hang back, hoping to catch a few more unsuspecting subjects. Another type of net, called a mist net, is set up in between some trees in a corridor that the bats often take from the bridge to a nearby field. Sweeping the light from her headlamp across the thin netting, Fish and Wildlife intern Jessica Ralston spots a bat and moves over to disentangle it.
Right now, I am trying to tangle this little fellow here. He's a bat out from the net. Oh, it's a tricky process. This is actually my first time untangling a bat. He keeps getting his arms stuck, though. Alyssa, I can't tell if this is around his neck or not. I don't want to hurt him. Just like, I got three parts of him free.
Oh, good. Okay, here, I'll take him.
You got him?
Yeah.
He's latched onto me right now.
There you go.
Oh, there you go, buddy.
So, I always picture, Jane, that this must feel like some kind of alien experience to them. You know how people describe their alien experiences as these bright lights and then all these invasive body examinations happening? And then, of course, that's exactly what we're doing. We're shining bright lights in their eyes. They were just out foraging for the night, and then this very strange, bizarre, scary thing happens. And then we take all sorts of measurements on them, and then we let them go. And, you know, I think they must say to their friends, this crazy thing happened. I was just flying around, and then the bright lights, and I was abducted, and all their friends are like, right.
So now he's going to go to processing once we get them all untangled.
The bat is placed in a small cloth bag that's carefully tied up so it can't squirm out. Bennett says the team tries to work quickly and to do minimal handling on the bats to try to keep their stress levels down. But the research is critical to finding a cure for white nose syndrome. Since the disease was found in New York caves in 2006, it has killed more than 5 million bats, and it's spread to most of the states and the Canadian provinces in the eastern side of the continent. 11 different hibernating species are affected by the fungus that causes the syndrome. The fungus can damage the skin and wing tissue of the bats, and infected bats often wake during winter hibernation and fly out of the caves, where they die of starvation or cold. Mortality rates hover around 90%, which is why this population of little brown bats is so exciting to scientists.
Tom, will you help me close the other myth net over here?
When Alyssa Bennett and the other researchers have gathered up 13 bats, they head over to Alyssa's truck to conduct those examinations. The setup is a little clunky. It's dark and still very mosquito-y. The assembled team is using headlamps for illumination, and they've spread out all kinds of test tubes and rubber gloves and swabs and a weighing scale on the bed of the truck. They're collecting data for a couple different research projects that scientists have asked them for help with, and each has a different protocol with a very specific and sometimes confusing set of instructions.
If you can figure out these data sheets, I thought I understood. Thank you.
Bennett gently picks up a bag, and with a gloved hand, she removes a small bat. It weighs little more than a nickel.
Wow, you're very light-colored. You look like a young bat. I'm going to bet that this is a young of the year. This is a very, very beautiful, light, dusty color to this bat, and sometimes the young of the year have that really light hair color. So this is a female. Feisty, that's good. So I'm just checking a couple of species-specific things. There's no keel on the calcar. The calcar is a little bone that comes off the back foot and gives some structure to the wing membrane on some bats. And on an Indiana bat, it would have almost like the shape of a keel of a boat. And on a little brown bat, it does not. And also the toe hairs extend out beyond their toes, unlike an Indiana bat. And their ears would just come to the tip of their nose if you bend them forward, whereas in a northern long-eared bat, they would extend a few millimeters beyond the nose. So those are some of the features we look at. This is the little brown bat. Milu, we call them. Some people call them Lucy's. So I can tell that this is a young of the year. So we can hold her. So she's not an adult, so we won't be able to use her for the sampling. We'd have to use her for the genomic sampling.
Some of the research has to be done on adult bats who have overwintered, presumably in the presence of white nose syndrome.
What these researchers are looking for is to find out why are certain bats surviving when others aren't. So they're taking samples from inside what we call the endemic zone. So the disease has been here for some time in Vermont, nearly as long as anywhere. And then they're taking some on kind of that leading edge where the disease has just hit. And then they're actually sampling bats that haven't been affected yet by white nose syndrome. So let's say we did find there was some association with survivors, such as something about their habitat, something about the underlying genetics, or in this case, something about the bacteria that's on their wings. And in that last scenario, the bacteria that's on their wings, people are actually looking into possible treatments for white nose syndrome, where you might actually take something that already lives in the environment of the bat in the cave or mine, or is on their own body. And if you were to in some way just had more, for example, that beneficial bacteria, could you in fact crowd out the fungus or protect the bat more? Could you protect bats that are more highly affected? So they're actually taking this information about the survivors, and then they're trying to find out if that's something they can apply to any treatment options.
So the team looks for another bat they can get a wing biopsy and other data from.
So this is a female. Yep, Myotis lucivagus, so Milu again. So we're just going to see if this is an adult. Yeah, so that looks like an adult. All we can tell is if they're the young of the year or they're an adult.
Or if they're banded, you'll be able to tell what year you banded them?
We don't have the data right in the truck with us, but we can go back and look through our records.
Is that fine?
In fact, later in the evening, the team did find a banded bat. When Bennett got back to her office the next day, she looked up the band number and made a remarkable discovery. This was one of the very individuals that Vermont Fish and Wildlife had banded back in 2006. Bennett said by phone that it was very exciting to find this bat. But just because she and a few of her colony mates have survived, that doesn't mean little brown bats are in the clear.
Because the truth is we're still seeing this species and the northern long-eared bat appear dead and dying outside of our largest hibernacula that we monitor in the winter. So knowing that and knowing that there are concerns that we're seeing a lower reproductive rate than we maybe did before white nose syndrome, those things do have us concerned still that this bat will hang on, even though their numbers seem to be stabilizing at this low 10% level.
At the best of times, little brown bats only have one pup a year, so recovery will be slow, and none of us will be alive to see numbers like we had before white nose syndrome. Nonetheless, Bennett says finding a bat like this, originally banded back in 2006, is a hopeful sign for the longevity of the species.
She had been an adult female at that time, and so then if you bring us to 2015, that says that she's at least 10 years old. And not only that, but she had survived every winter that white nose syndrome has been known to be in Vermont. And that, I think, is an amazing feat. And she had some scars to show for it.
Little brown bats can live 20, sometimes even 30 years. So with any luck, not only will this tiny bat continue to thrive, but she might help ensure the survival of her entire species. Most regular new cars in the United States these days are automatic transmission, so driving a stick shift is something fewer and fewer people in this country know how to do. And it can be a little intimidating to think about learning, especially as an adult. So today in summer school, we're going to get belted in for a pep talk and a lesson from Paul Dudley of Dudley's Driving School in Waitsfield.
People find driving a manual transmission intimidating at first, absolutely. And the biggest thing about that is the hardest part is the first part you learn, and that's just taking off, launching the car from 0 miles an hour. The first thing that I'll have a student do is I'll have them just push down on the clutch pedal, just to feel how it goes down, to feel how it goes out, to kind of train their leg. So then I'll have them feel the gear pattern, feel the shift pattern. Just go through and find neutral, find all the gears. It's always written right on the shifter what gear is what. And I'll show them where reverse is. Then it'll be time to start the car. Start the car and put the car in first gear with the clutch pedal down. Anytime you're going to have the car in gear when it's not moving, the clutch has to be down all the way. Because the clutch pedal, what it really does is it separates the engine from the transmission and drive wheel so the engine can spin freely even though the car isn't moving. So then I'll just have them launch a few times, just very, very slowly, not even touching the gas pedal, just really letting the clutch pedal out until it starts to grab, and that's called the friction point. And then you'll notice that the RPMs start to drop and the car starts to walk forward. So I'll just have them do that a few times, just so they can just feel what the clutch does. And then we'll start adding in, giving it a little bit of gas. So it's sort of like footsteps. You're getting a little bit of gas in there as you're letting the clutch pedal out. And it's kind of a dance. It really is. It's like the clutch dance. I'll certainly try and put them in a position where they can stall the car. Because you're going to stall the car. It's absolutely okay to stall the car. It's going to happen. It's going to happen to me this week. And I've been driving standards for 20 years. Once they're comfortable launching the car, we'll start going through the gears. A shift from any given gear, once you're up to speed, should take about a second. And it's really five things. You're letting your right foot off the gas. You're pushing your left foot all the way down. You're shifting the gear. You're letting the clutch pedal back out. And you're starting to give it a little bit of gas again. So it's five things in about 1 second. Everyone that I have driven with gets an immense sense of accomplishment and satisfaction from really being more involved in the driving experience. I'm an automotive enthusiast, love driving, love racing cars. To see manual transmissions disappearing almost systematically by car manufacturers makes me sad. I'd like to see them stick around and people become more enthusiastic about them, about driving in general. So I'm trying to keep that third pedal alive.
Thank you.
That's Paul Dudley. He teaches driver's ed and driving skills at Dudley's Driving School in Waitsfield, and he specializes in teaching people manual transmission. And that does it for today's show. In the last few weeks, your CSA and your own garden have probably been bearing more vegetables than you ever thought possible. Now you have to figure out what to do with all of them. Tomorrow, we'll get expert advice on preparing your veggies. Send your questions, comments, or tips on cooking with vegetables to vermontedition@vpr.net and listen tomorrow at noon. I also want to put a plug in. We are looking for our fall intern. The internship application is due on the 24th of August. So if you are a college student in Vermont or know a college student in Vermont who might like to intern with Vermont Edition, go to vpr.net to find the full application materials. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.